Could we all please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Bo from, I believe, Visalia?
I guess I gotta unmute myself. Can you guys hear me? I guess so. Well, anyway, that I hate staring at myself in the. I have to look like I'm talking to myself in the mirror here. I'm not sure how to change that.
I think you swipe left or swipe right.
How do you swipe right or left? Let's see, stop.
It should have been gone by now, Bo.
Okay.
Gallery view?
Yeah, I think I got it. Yeah, I'm not... Oh, I don't even see me at all. All I see is Jim. I mean, Bill. I got a big picture of Bill. Let me see here.
What's so wrong with that?
Well, I guess not a thing. Anyway.
So there might be a little waffle up at the top in your right-hand corner. If you click on the waffle, it'll show everybody's pictures.
Oh, okay. There we go. I got you all back now. Yeah, and it's a whole lot better than me. You know, I stare in the mirror a lot, you know, but I like the guy looking back. Okay, we'll start now. I'm Bo, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's kind of unusual. You know, if you'd have told me 45 years ago that I'd be sober this long and be talking on a computer to other AA meeting, AA members, you know, I'm not sure what I would have told you. You know, but here we are. You know, I am not sure what to talk about, so I guess I'll try to talk a little bit about how it was and a little bit about what happened and how it is now. But, you know, being sober, you know, for this length of time, over two-thirds of my life have been in AA. So if all I talk about is my growing up before I got here, you're going to miss two-thirds of it. You know, So I'm going to try to keep my drunk-a-log kind of brief. You know, I guess you would say that my first drinking experience, which also, by the way, I guess was my first bad drinking experience, I was about 3 years old, you know, and this is as far back as I can remember. You know, I lived in an all-black community in Gary, Indiana. And my mother would let us kids play in the backyard as long as we didn't go out the gate or cross the street or anything. We had to stay in the backyard. That was the rule. You know, but there was a bar that was right across the street from the house, you know. And one morning, it was a sunny morning, and I guess the bartender threw out a bunch of old bottles. Whiskey bottles, you know, and he had this garbage can full of whiskey bottles. And the sun was shining on them, and they were glittering and this and that. And I knew I wasn't supposed to leave the yard across the street, you know, 3 years old. I knew that. But I was curious about what was, you know, the reflection off of those bottles. You know, I wanted to see what was going on. So I opened up the gate, you know, and I crossed the street. You know, and I was over there, and I was looking at these bottles, and I noticed that there was a little bit of alcohol on the bottom of the bottles. I guess you call them spiders, you know. And I was wondering, you know, what that tastes like, you know. So I had to pick up one of the bottles. I had to hold it up like this, you know, until it would drain, you know, and I had it touch me on I had my tongue, you know, touch it, and it tastes like crap. It tastes awful. You know, I guess, you know, my alcoholic curiosity or whatever it was, you know, personality, you know, my thought came to mind that, well, maybe the next one will taste different. You know, so I grabbed another one, you know, and I held it upside down and waited for the liquor to hit the end of the bottle, you know, and out the corner of my eye while I was doing that, I could see my mother running across the street with a big switch in her hand, And thus was my first bad drinking experience. You know, I just thought I would explain that, you know. Now, you would think that might be a warning or something for me, but it was, you know, my folks were devoted Catholics. You know, I was in a Catholic family. I was brought up. I'd been confirmed and communed and all that, you know. And you know what they say about Catholics? When you find wherever you find four Catholics, you'll usually find a fifth. You know, so I had to, you know, I grew up around alcohol a lot. My folks didn't drink, though. They never really drank that much. You know, the only time they ever see them pick up anything was when they were with my other relatives who did drink a lot. You know, so I would sip on it here and there, but I never got enough of it in me until I was around 13. Now, you know, a lot of people might like to think, you know, that alcohol made me a thief, made me a liar, and made me a cheat. But that's not true. By the time I was 13, I was already a liar, a cheat, and a thief. I was already all those things, you know. I didn't develop them because of drinking. Excuse me. But behind my mother's garage, at the ripe old age of 13, being a shy, red-haired, blue-eyed kid, I started drinking with a bunch of friends of mine back then, and I was amazed before I was halfway through drinking. You know, I finally got enough to get that a magical feeling. You know, I didn't regret my past or wish to shut the door on it when I was drinking. I could comprehend the word serenity when I was drinking. I knew peace when I was drinking. You know, no matter how far down the scale I went, I could see how my experiences could benefit others when I was drinking. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity just disappeared when I was drinking. I intuitively knew how to handle situations, which used to baffle me when I was drinking. And I suddenly realized that alcohol was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I mean, you know, I was, like I said, at 13, I had bright red hair, you know, blue eyes, a zillion freckles, you know, and I was very shy. I don't know if you believe that today, but I was very shy. You know, I couldn't talk to girls at that age without stuttering so much my freckles would shake. You know, but get enough booze in me and I could ask him anything. And did. You know, I'm not sure if that's real good or not, but, you know, I did. You know, and I continued to drink like that. You know, from that time on, I didn't drink just to drink, just to be one of the guys or just to, you know, for peer pressure or whatever. I drank to try to get those promises. I drank to get that feeling, you know, that I felt that first time behind my mother's garage. You know, I drank for that reason. And I couldn't get that feeling unless I got almost drunk, you know. But I would usually cross the line and I'd wind up drunk. And that feeling would last sometimes at first, and it lasted a long time or a lot longer. But as I drank, that feeling lasted, but it didn't last as long, you know. And I found myself drinking like that until I got into this program. It was still working a little bit, you know, but not as much as it did when I first started. I was 19 when the draft was around, you know, and the Vietnam War was going on, 1971. And I knew I was going to get drafted. So I had to go down and get a GED test, you know, and I get a high school diploma and I joined the Navy, you know, to keep from being drafted in the Army. I figured, you know, being on a ship would be a lot better than being in a foxhole, you know, so I did that, you know, and I wound up going to boot camp in Great Lakes, you know, and then from there I went over to AOA school where you learn how to build bombs and missiles and rockets, you know. And then from there I went to Lemoore, California. Now, I was in Jacksonville, Florida when I went to the AOA school, you know. And I remember they sent me a set of orders from there that said I was my next duty station was going to be Lemoore, California. Now, I was 19 at the time, you know, and everything I had learned in Gary, Indiana about California, I learned from Walt Disney movies, you know. So when they told me that I was going to go to NAS Lemoore, California, man, I'm thinking, all right, me and Annette Filicello on the beach with Frankie Avalon, you know, they're going to be the surfboards and the fancy cars and the waves coming in off the ocean, you know, and the parties and all that. And I'm thinking, all right, man, and I've arrived, you know. So I couldn't wait, you know. I took leave, went home to Indiana for a little bit, and then I took a flight from O'Hara to San Francisco, and then I had to get a flight from San Francisco to Fresno. Now, this is in March of 1972. You know, and I met a Marine on that flight from Frisco to Fresno, and he said his buddies were going to come and pick him up on the, you know, and take him to the base, and I could ride along with him if I wanted. And I did, you know. And when we got to Fresno, it was foggy. The Thule fog had set in, you know, and you couldn't see nothing. You know, but I didn't say anything about it, you know. I figured that was the fog coming in off the ocean, you know, like it does in England or whatever. You know, so the very first look I got of this area was out the third story window of Barracks 4, overlooking the old, what's now the old Navy Exchange, and then miles and miles and nothing but miles and miles and nothing. You know, I mean, with a good set of binoculars, you can watch your dog run away from home for 3 days. You know, it's just that open. You know, and I was thinking, my God, I said, this is a Navy base. Where the hell's the ocean? You know, where's the ships? I asked another sailor. I said, where's the ocean at? You know, and he saw an opportunity, and he thought, he told me that they brought the carrier up Kings River to pick us up. I didn't know any better. I'm 19 years old, so I, you know, when I saw Kings River, I figured it out. But still, you know, I didn't like this place at all. You know, it didn't take me long to find the EM club. You know, and you could drink on base. You know, it didn't matter. You know, as long as you were in the service, you could drink. You didn't have to be 21. So I took a lot of advantages of that. And I went on a couple of cruises, you know, one in 73, you know, and then another one in 74 over the Tonka Gulf. And I did a lot of drinking there, you know, in the Philippines and Hong Kong. And, you know, my first two cruises, you know, in the service, I was drinking. And the only thing, I went to Hong Kong and Singapore and the Philippines and Japan and all these other places, you know, and the only thing I can remember about those two cruises was the inside of a bar room someplace, you know, be it in Hong Kong or Singapore or whatever. I was always in that bar room. I didn't see much of anything, you know. And then, you know, and I think about that today, and, you know, I guess drinking was that much important to me. You know, I wound up back here in the States, you know, in December of 74, you know, and my sister was engaged to a guy who was my old drinking buddy. I met it at Lemoore, you know, and they were seeing one another. I took him home on leave, and they met one another, and they were writing to one another. My sister got herself in the service, and she got herself stationed over here. And her and Michael were going together, you know. And Michael had some AA, you know, for his brother, you know. And I got back, you know, and in December of 74, and I seen them, and Michael was doing real well, not drinking, So I figured, you know, I won't hang around him, you know, when I'm drinking. So I didn't hang around him much anymore, you know. I stayed away. You know, I just drank on my own, you know. And in March of 75, I got a DUI. You know, I was in the duty status, you know, and I was supposed to be, you know, standing by, you know, a phone, you know, in case they needed me to show up in the base. But I was out drinking, you know, and carousing, you know, and this, and I used my recall number. I used the bar, Smokey's payphone, as my recall number, which really wasn't real smart, but I did it. You know, and I wound up getting a DUI that night, you know, trying to get back home from the bar. And I remember distinctly telling the police officer, you know, that he really ought to let me go. I had a watch in a few hours, and I'd driven this car home in a lot worse shape than this, you know. And of course, Mothers Against Drunk Driving wasn't around then, and all that other, you know, stuff. The DUIs was nothing more than a traffic ticket, like running a stop sign then, you know. But they took me to the drunk tank in Hanford, and I couldn't stand to watch because I was in a drunk tank in Hanford, you know. And I didn't get in much trouble for the DUI, but I got in a lot of trouble because I was drunk on duty, you know. The Navy frowned on that, you know. So what the Navy did was they sent me to Michael, you know, who wound up being it wasn't a counselor. All they did was put him in a set of whites then, you know, and they handed him a stack of just regular index cards, you know, and whenever they sent somebody to him, he had to tell them that they had to go to two outside AA meetings a week for 90 days and take that little index card and have the secretary or whatever sign the card, and I'd bring it back to him, you know. The court systems didn't have the court cards there yet, you know, so I was the only one carrying a card to the meetings, you know, and I had to do that. Now, when I showed up at Mike's, you know, he was supposed to tell me I only had to go to two meetings a week for 90 days, but he knew me, and he told me that I had to go to three. And he volunteered to take me to the very first one, you know. And if you look at the sidewalk over there at the Methodist Church in Hanford, where I went to my first meeting, you could probably still see the claw marks on the sidewalk, you know. It was just, you know, I really didn't think I needed to do that. I back up a little bit. I found out in Fallon, Nevada, just before I had to go see Michael, that I couldn't quit drinking. I found out, I thought, you know, getting this DUI and the duty status, getting in all this trouble, that alcohol was maybe affecting my life a little bit, you know, so I vowed to quit drinking forever. Never again was alcohol going to cross my lips, up or down, you know. And in Fallon, Nevada, you know, I tried that, and I lasted a good 5 days. You know, a payday weekend came up, and I'm in Fallon, Nevada, you know, at the naval station over there, you know, and in Nevada they had drinking and gambling and whatever, because whatever was legal in Nevada, you know, the Mustang Ranch and what have you, you know. And I, you know, a Friday night, you know, we got paid, I think I had like $365, something like that, you know, and all the other sailors were putting their civilian clothes on and getting ready to go out to off lake, you know, and go into Fallon, the city of Fallon, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm not going to drink, but I'll cash that check and I'll go into town and watch everybody else have fun. You know, and needless to say, in about a couple hours, I was drinking too, you know, and I wound up on the flight line, you know, that Monday morning, you know, 2.5 days later, You know, I had to borrow $20 to get back to the base, and I'm on the flight line. It's about 4:30, 5 in the morning. You know, sun's just barely coming up over those mountains over there. I got a hangover, $20 in debt 3 days after payday, and I'm feeling miserable. You know, 22 years old, being broke 3 days after payday, that wasn't unusual. You know, and having a hangover on Monday certainly wasn't unusual. You know, but what was unusual and what I didn't really like about it was the fact that I really meant to quit drinking forever. I really meant to stop. You know, but I couldn't. I could not quit. And I realized that. I realized that I was not going to be able to quit drinking. I was going to have to try to figure out how to manage it or how to get along with it, but I could not quit, period. I didn't like that. I didn't like the fact that something, you know, that came out of a bottle had that much control over me. Hang on a second. It really was upsetting. But even though I knew I could not quit drinking, I did not think I was as bad as an alcoholic. You know, I mean, those people are really sick. But so I wind up back from Fallon, and like I said, I had to go see Michael, and he gave me that index card, and I had to take it to meetings, you know. And I wound up going to AA meetings. Now, I'd like to say that, you know, as soon as I got in AA, I got busy, you know, and put my head to the grindstone and started working the steps, you know, and practicing all the traditions and all of this. That'd be nice if I could say I did that. But I didn't. You know, I didn't do none of that. You know, I did the first half of step one. I didn't drink. And then I went all the way over to step 13. You know, I skipped all the other ones. You know, I knew about those steps, you know, but I used those to talk crap, you know, or to talk, you know, like I knew what I was doing, just so I could 13 step, you know. And life was not manageable. Life was not nice. Life was pretty miserable. You know, I didn't like me. I didn't like you. I didn't like, you know, being sober. I didn't like any of that, you know, and I did this. I did this for about 2.5-3 years. And, you know, I was just here. I was just sober. S-O-B-E-R. Son of a bitch. Everything's real. Sober. You know, it just wasn't good. You know, it wasn't what everybody else was doing, you know. And I remember being in AA at that time, you know, I see other people come in after I did, you know, and they would sit around, you know, and they'd be shaking so much sometimes that they couldn't put a cigarette out in an ashtray that big without knocking all the other ashes, cigarette butts out of it and ashes all over. You know, they couldn't hold on to a cup of coffee without shaking it all off of them, you know, and in about 2 or 3 weeks, you know, they stop drinking, you know, and they turn their will and their life over to some higher power or what have you, and they start trying to practice these steps or whatever it was, and look, they seem to change. They seem to be reborn. A little light would show up in their eyes, and they'd stop shaking so much. You know, they could actually hold on to a full cup of coffee. And I'm looking at them, you know, while I'm practicing my way of staying sober, you know, by just not drinking. Tight jaw, white knuckle sobriety, what I like to call that. You know, and I would wonder, well, when the hell is this going to happen to me? When am I going to get this? How come these people can get this way, and when am I going to get it? You know, and by this time I was in Florida, you know, and people would tell me, you know, to try to practice the steps. And I knew better, you know, and I didn't want to do that. But, you know, I got so miserable. I got to where I hated me so much, and I didn't like you, and I didn't like life. You know, and I thought, well, you know what? So they keep talking about these steps. Well, then I'll do it. I'll try these steps. And when they don't work for me, then it's going to be AA's fault that I had to drink. You know, not my fault. It could never be my fault. You know, it always had to be somebody else's fault. It always had to be something else. I had to be a victim. You know, I could never be responsible for my own actions. It always had to be something else. You know, so I figure, all right, well, I'll try these steps, and when they don't work for me, yeah, then I'll be free to drink, and it'll be AA's fault. You know, and I tried them. You know, my first fourth step was a half a page, big print. You know, space, you know, double space, you know, and there wasn't enough information on there to make a halfway decent paragraph. You know, and I brought that to a guy that later on became my first sponsor, or my second sponsor, actually. I did a fifth step with him, you know, and something happened, you know. Even though it was so minute, you know, I started to feel a little bit better about it. You know, it wasn't what I thought. You know, they didn't shun me away, and they didn't, tell me I was no good. You know, it just seemed to bring me a little closer. And I got something out of it. And it was just like behind my mother's garage at the age of 13. You know, I started to feel a little bit of those promises, you know. A little bit. Just a little bit, you know. You know, I was amazed upon us halfway through with the steps. And I found a new freedom and a new happiness. I didn't regret my past, you know. Or shut the door on it. These things started to happen for me when I worked these little bitty steps. And I got to thinking, well, you know, if just doing that little bit did that for me, maybe doing more would do more. You know, just like I was behind my mom's garage. You know, if I drank more, I'd get more profit. Well, I worked those steps over and over and over. I've been doing it now for a little over 45 years, you know, and I have no idea how many fifth steps I've done or how many fourth steps I've done. You know, I remember, you know, when I retired from the Navy, I drove trucks for about 15 years, you know, and about six of those years, I was over the road, you know, and I would try AA meetings all over the country, and you know, and I would share some of my fifth steps right there in the AA meeting, you know, and nobody really knew it was my fifth step, you know, but they didn't shut me away, you know, they just seemed to get closer to me or something, and that was amazing. And, you know, I got out of the Navy. I was going through my first divorce. You know, and I blamed the Navy for that. So I got out of the Navy in 79, and I went to COS. I didn't want to go back home to Indiana because I knew going back home would I'd be around my old drinking buddies and friends and high school chums and stuff. And I kind of figured what would happen if I got around all them old people, people, you know, friends. So I wanted to stay away from there, you know. So I joined the reserves, and I went to COS. And I liked doing things with my hands. I liked, drafting and this and that. So I went into COS, you know, with the curriculum of math, science, and engineering, which happens to be one of the toughest curriculums over there in at COS, you know, and I remember I'm in the dean of men's office, and they had the serenity prayer up on the wall. I don't know why it was there, but it was there, you know, and I remember the dean of men was looking at my transcripts from high school, which weren't very good, you know. They were, I think I got an incomplete physical education because I wouldn't get into shorts and exercise. I told the coach, you know, that I wasn't going to do that, you know. I was up all night working. You know, my dad had a stroke when I was 15. You know, so I was helping to support the family. I only had to go to school half a day and go to work after that. But I was drinking most of the night, you know, with a lot of that money I was making. And and I wasn't gonna, you know, participate. The gym, so he, you know, he just gave me an incomplete on physical education. And a lot of my grades were D's and F's. I think the highest grade I got in high school was a C. So he's looking at those transcripts from my high school days in Hobart, Indiana, and he looks at me and he says, "Mr. Beaupre," he said, "I don't think you have the study habits required for this curriculum. You know, maybe we should try something else." And I, you know, by this time I was sober just a little over 4 years, you know, and I said, "Well, let's try it, you know, and if I can't do it, we'll do something else." You know, and he kind of chuckled to himself, you know, and I read the Serenity Prayer on his wall, and we did that, you know, and I remember, you know, the first couple of semesters, I had to take a lot of bonehead classes, you know, bonehead algebra and English and this and that, because I didn't do these in high school. You know, so I had to take those for prerequisites, you know, and I went to AA meetings, I ate, I slept, and I studied. That was it. And I wound up getting a 4.0 grade point average for the first three semesters at that college, you know. And I remember it was the second semester or the third semester. I'm living over here on Chinowit, off of Chinowit, that little trailer court, you know, and I get this letter from the college, and it says, "Mr. Beaupre," he says, "this letter is to inform you that you're now on the dean's list." You know, and I got mad. I said, "What the hell?" I said, "I've been, you know, showing up for school, and, you know, and I've been getting good grades, and, you know, I'm doing real well. I'm not upsetting the class, you know, or getting into any fights like I did in high school, this and that. You know, what do they got me on the dean's list for?" You know, I thought I was so mad. You know, so I went over to the college, and I found one of the counselors there, and I told her that. I said, why you guys got me on the dean's list? I've been doing well here, you know. She looked up at me and she said, "Well, Mr. Beaupre," she said, "that's a good thing." You know, and I, you know, I got embarrassed and I laughed, you know. But I mean, I was on the dean's list in high school too, but it wasn't the same list, I guess. You know, so, it, you know, I didn't keep the grade 4.0. I wound up with I think it was a 3.2 or 3.4 grade point average, you know. And I got that associate's degree in math, science, and engineering. And, you know, I ran out of the GI Bill while I was doing that. So I had a choice. Either I was in the reserves, you know, because the reserves was paying me $100 a month, you know, to do one weekend, you know. And, of course, I had to keep my hair short and this and that, but, you know, it was a living. You know, I went to a lot of meetings at Pine Manor then. Pine Manor used to have lunch, you know, after the meetings at noon. And I would go to the meetings there, you know, and after the meeting, for a dollar, you could eat lunch. If it hadn't have been for that, I probably would have starved to death. I wasn't making a whole lot of money when I was going to school, paying the rent, buying books, you know, and this and that, you know, so I, you know, it helped me out. You know, and I, you know, and I had a decision to make after I got that degree, you know. I could either work for somebody for about 30 years and maybe get some type of retirement, you know, or I could go back in the Navy for another 12 years that I'd already done 8, you know, and retire and then go do what I want. So I decided, well, I'll just go back in the Navy. I didn't necessarily like the Navy, you know. So I tried to get in the Air Force, but they told me I couldn't because I, get this, I was overqualified to be in the Air Force. You know, I knew too much. You know, that's kind of strange, you know. The Air Force kind of runs things where they want people that know just about one different thing, you know, and don't know about other things combined with it, you know, and And there's 18 different jobs in the Air Force for the one ordnance job that I did in the Navy. So I knew 18 different parts of the jobs, you know, while I was in, you know, they wouldn't let me go in the Air Force because of that. You know, so I had to go back in the Navy. And you know, I made another six cruises in the Navy in the 12 years that I was there, you know, and I was sober. I was sober a little over 17 years in the service as an ordnanceman, you know, a first-class supervisor, you know, in charge of telling people how to build bombs, missiles, rockets, and launchers, and all this other stuff, you know, and it was kind of interesting. You know, some parts of it I liked, and a lot of parts of it I didn't, you know.
Hey,
but, yes.
Well, I just, we're about out of time if you want to wrap up. Any final thoughts before we finish?
I'm sorry. I didn't know if I'd be able to talk for 40 minutes, but I guess we can. Anyhow, you know, I went to a lot of places and done a lot of things sober, you know, and my life today is a lot better than I ever thought it would be. You know, I never thought I'd live to be over 40, and here I am, I'll be 68 next month. You know, and I'm really glad to be here, and I hope I might have said something for somebody out there, you know, who's just getting here. You know, work the steps. Do the best you can with them, you know, one day at a time, you know, and let God take care of the outcome. You know, because, you know, it's not up to me what happens. It's up to my higher power. But my higher power doesn't do any manual labor. You know, I have to do the manual labor, and I have to let him make the decisions. That's about all I got. Thanks.